Hi, I'm Jason Schultz. I'm a clinical professor at UC Berkeley School of Law, so similar to what Chris does, but on the other coast. And I also used to be a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
David?
Hi, I'm Dave Hosp. I'm a partner at Goodwin Procter here in town. I do a bunch of pro bono work for the Boston Public Library, which I think at the moment has one of the largest electronic library projects going on, although the Harvard project will probably take over. and I've also been involved on a number of issues sort of relevant to this, particularly tried the Cablevision case a number of years ago, and currently am lead trial counsel for Aereo, which is in the middle of briefing before we get a decision.
I'm Sherwin C. I'm deputy legal director at Public Knowledge. We're a DC-based nonprofit, and we work on IP and telecommunications issues. I think our basic mission is to make sure that information can flow over the internet and communications networks without undue interference from either intermediaries or the excessive application of copyright law.
I'm Phil Malone. I'm a clinical professor at Harvard Law School and direct the Cyber Law Clinic with Chris there at the law school.
Great. I think we're going to start our dive into these issues in the patent realm. And Jason, I'd love to have you talk just for a few minutes about the Defensive Patent License Project, which I'll try and throw up on the screen while we're talking about it here.
Great. So when we had a call before this panel, we were talking about, you know, kind of themes. And one of the things that I think as lawyers, it's good to think about, well, what can non-lawyers do, or what are their options, and sort of, you know, make it so they don't always have to run to lawyers for answers, because often you hate that. And so in line with a lot of the kind of legal hacks that have happened over several decades, back to some of the beginning free software and open source licenses, there have always been these sort of ways in which when you create code or you create art or you create whatever you create as a problem solver or as an artist, that you might be able to sort of put it for good instead of for evil, whatever your definitions of those are. And so people think about the GPL and BSD licenses and Apache licenses and those kind of approaches, or Creative Commons and the kind of more cultural space, as things you can do. You actually have control over what kind of legal regime the things you create participate in, and what they might help with. And especially if network effects kick in, and then lots of people do it, and it kind of builds, or it goes viral, or those things. But one of the most frustrating areas when thinking about these kinds of tools has been patents. And in copyright, with computer code and with sort of more visual and aesthetic creative works, you know, it's not perfect, but the sort of licensing systems in copyright have been fairly effective at giving people at least most, if not all, the options they generally want, and kind of attaching the conditions that seem to resonate with at least majority or strong, significant sections of the population, such as if you use my code and then distribute something you wrote using it or modifying it, you then have to just abide by the same kinds of rules, which means you have to release your code under the same license. Or with Creative Commons, attribution being a key component that really is required if you're going to use material. So with patents, there's been so much going on the patent realm, and especially in the last 5 or 6 years, Supreme Court cases, alleged patent reform in Congress, a lot of complaints about patent trolls, a lot of complaints about particular software patents or other business method type patents, and there's a range of complaints about what's going on in the patent system. And so my colleague Jennifer Urban and I at Berkeley, and along with a lot of other folks who really helped us think this through, said, well, can we design a similar type legal thing that if you patent something, you can actually try and make it sort of committed for good in whatever way that might be? And one of the main kind of central norms or values people said is, well, you know, I probably come up with stuff all the time that's patentable, and if I work in a company, these lawyers come around and I kind of don't trust them, because they're always like, what are they going to do with my stuff, right? I wrote this code. Are they going to make it evil? Are they going to sell it to some troll? And I have no control over that. And there have been other solutions proposed, and we don't have time to talk about it on this panel right now, but I'm happy to talk about it a bit later, or people can go to this website that we just created if you want to learn. But one of the ideas is that maybe at the moment of creation or kind of at the beginning, you could commit to certain things, or the company could commit to certain things, which really will kind of stick with the patent, that they can't be removed, they can't be taken away from the patent over time. So if any of you read at all about Twitter recently, I guess about a month ago, announced an inventor patent agreement, an IPA, I just remember it because of the beer. Really try to give its employees, its software engineers, some control over the sort of what happens with the patent down the road, that they can somewhat object to certain lawsuits if they think they're troll-like or aggressive and not defensive. And this defensive patent license is something similar, but on a much broader, bigger scale, more than one inventor, more than one company. The idea is about defensive patenting. It's been this tradition in patent industries and tech industries for a very long time, which is you are patenting things, but you're not really going to aggressively pursue people who are competing with you or any of that. You're just saving them in reserve in case you get sued. So, you know, if Apple sues Motorola, now Google, fires back, and then over time you kind of work it out. It's a deterrence thing, a sort of mutually assured destruction, whatever warfare analogy you want to use, kind of idea. But the notion of defensive patenting, of the idea of preventing lawsuits, is definitely a core one. The other one, though, is also that you make sure no one else patents it. In other words, it allows you to get there first and say, look, I invented this, and no one else can come along later and claim they invented it. Because if someone comes along later and claims they invented it, then you might actually end up on the defensive yourself. They might sue you, and you have to prove, in fact, 3 years ago in some code base you came up with that code, and that could be very expensive and time-consuming. Whereas if you've already patented it, you just show them the patent. You say, yeah, you think you did that? Well, here. Or the patent office, when they get the future application, just looks at it and says, no, these guys did it before. It's right here in the patent database. So this is all well and good, but how do you keep these things from being evil? So the idea, and again, the website, which is defensivepatentlicense.com, which is not simple, but is straightforward and was available, sort of goes through some of the, we're just launching it, actually. It's in beta or whatever right now. We just actually put it up over the weekend. And it's going to have more commentary, and it's going to link to more things. There's even also a link to a Google Doc, GitHub, and a PDF version of the license if you want to play with them or comment on them. It's a definite model license, beta license at this point. But the idea is that if you want to be part of this network of defensive patent people, you are committing that all of your patents, every single thing you've done, will be available royalty-free to anybody who wants to take a license if they also commit to only practicing defensive patenting. In other words, if against anyone who makes some agreement. So if you think about it, there are all these people who could sign up for the DPL, as we're calling it, and as long as they don't offensively sue anyone else in that network, everyone's cool. The minute any of them might sue another DPL user, and any license that they have taken can be revoked. So the license is irrevocable, can't be taken away from you. You have it forever for free to all the patents for any DPL user. So you don't have to pay any money. You can just never worry about them. In fact, if there's explicit technology you want, you can go get it. And all you have to do is commit to not being an offensive patent aggressor. And if you are then later an offensive patent aggressor, you all your licenses can be revoked and you can be sued. And so the idea is that it encourages you to stay defensive. And then the idea is as the network grows, more and more licenses are available. And in theory, you can imagine 1,000 or 10,000 patent licenses, some of them very fundamental to the web, all being freely available, all being kind of claimed so no troll can go claim them. And then all being there as long as you stay defensive. And so the incentives to kind of stay defensive grow over time. I'll say one last thing and then I'll turn it over for time. We've done a lot of work. There's a lot of game playing, obviously, that goes on, and lawyers are smart and like to game the system, right? And so obviously there are going to be a lot of attempts to poke holes in this, and we're aware of those, and I'm happy to talk about them. One thing I'll say is that we've really tried to think through what happens if the patent gets sold off, what happens if the patent goes through bankruptcy, like the company that created it, like, you know, say Twitter goes through bankruptcy, what happens to its patents and stuff like that. And we think we've worked it out where the conditions will travel with the patent and that will be part of any, you're required to condition any sale of the patent in the same way, which means that these so-called patent trolls who kind of sweep up these patents and try and use them aggressively, they'll have almost no incentive to buy a DPL'd patent in terms of suing any DPL users. Now, they might still buy it to go after non-DPL people, people who don't want to be part of this license world, much like the open source versus proprietary kind of, you have these two separate worlds. But the trolls won't go after the DPL people because they already have an irrevocable license forever for free, unless, of course, they go offensive. And so we think that also will decrease the sort of weapon supply of trolls in that sense, and that they probably will look other places than these kinds of patents. They could try and dismantle the license, but again, I think that overhead will be even more discouragement for them. So anyway, I can say more, there's more on the website, but it's something that we're hoping that folks who actually write code and fix systems and do all the engineering work might be interested in, both doing individually, but also encouraging their entities and organizations to think about, because we think it can really shift some of the patent problems.
So many questions, lots of great stuff there, and I think what we'll do is kind of go down the line and have each of you make a do a short presentation like that, at which point I'm going to try and kind of elicit some further questions, and absolutely at that point want to make sure and involve the rest of the audience too. So thanks, Jason. Dave, anything you want to start with?
Sure. Jason started out by talking about trying to develop a system where people wouldn't have to run to lawyers. I find that a little offensive. Can I ask just how many people in the room are actually lawyers or have legal training of some sort?
Everyone okay. On this side.
So apparently there's some sort of split. Nice. You guys like not like each other at all? Yeah. Is there a rivalry going on?
Mirror universe.
So, well, I want to make sure that you know, as I talk through what it is that I do, and particularly when I work with clients, that I'm giving you useful information. What I do is I work primarily in the copyright and trademark fields. I work with a lot of technologists. I work with a lot of companies as they are really starting to work on their technology and all the way through implementation. And some of that, the reason that people come to me is because very often, particularly when they're working in the technology sector, and particularly if they're working with the internet, which is obviously the largest content distribution platform ever conceived of, a lot of times they're dealing with other people's content. A lot of times they're dealing with other people's copyrighted material. This is material, in the words of the Copyright Act, that has been fixed, embodied in a fixed form and is retained in a fixed form for a period sufficient for it to be considered a work. You can think of that as, you know, writings, music, audiovisual works, pretty much anything that you think of as creative endeavors. Those are ultimately embodied and therefore protected under copyright, which means that whoever did that, whoever created that, has certain rights. Certain rights as to the making of copies of that work, certain rights with respect to the performance or the public performance of those works, the distribution of those works. And so a lot of times what you have is a situation where a client or a potential client will have conceived of a new way to get something out there, a new technology that will allow video players to play better, a new technology that will allow the internet to pick up over-the-air broadcast signals, various different technologies that will allow implementation either on the internet or through other means. and they're not content creators, they are technologists. One of the key questions that they have to ask themselves early on is, who's going to get mad at me? And what are they going to do about it? And there is a process. I'm a partner in the trial department at Goodwin. I am a trial lawyer, but that does not mean that all I do is trial work. I work with clients very often from the very early stages of their development, and part of that is the notion of, You know, what some people pejoratively like to describe as getting around the law. I don't like that description at all. I don't think that that's a fair description at all. And there is obviously a tension with respect to the pace at which the law develops versus the pace at which technology develops. There is a wild disconnect between those two paces. At the same time, the way the law is supposed to work is its decisions, statutes, laws are supposed to give those people out there who are working on creative endeavors the ability to figure out what it is that they can and cannot do. The goal is not just to, I mean, obviously each case is decided on its own facts, and each case is decided based on the particular technology that's in front of that judge. But the goal really should be, and very often is, to decide cases in a way that allows people out there to take from that what the rules are and figure out from those rules what they can do and what they can't do. And so I really don't think of it as getting around the law. I think of it as recognizing what the law is, analyzing what that is, analyzing it not just from the standpoint of the specifics of a decision or the specifics of a statute, but figuring out what were the public policies behind that statute or that decision. Because ultimately, in all likelihood, depending on how creative you are, even if you fall into a situation where you really think that you have decided, you really have created something that falls fairly clearly within the four corners of, for example, a precedent that's already been decided, somebody's going to probably challenge that, and somebody's going to try to change the law. And you know, that really is something that you need to think about, and so you need to examine whether or not you meet not just the technical language of a particular law or a decision, but also how far are you pushing that precedent? How far are you pushing it such that it might be scaled back to not include you anymore? And that's what I do. That's what I've done with lots of clients over the years. I'm not going to talk particularly about active matters very much, because I have a number of active matters that are very much in the news these days, and are still under consideration by various judges. But I'm more than happy to talk or answer any questions about the nature of that process and what it is that I try to engage in with my clients. But for the moment, I'll pass it on.
That's great. Sherwin?
All right, so thanks. And I'm guessing the rest of us on the panel don't have those same restrictions, so I'm sure we'll be happy to discuss with clients later on in the panel. But I wanted to cover something, an issue called the first sale doctrine and how that intersects with digital works. And the thing about the first sale doctrine, it's a core piece of the copyright law. And it really, it affects how we interact with pretty much every type of media that we own. You know, our relationship with books, with movies, with music is predicated upon this doctrine and how it works. And all of that is going to change, or can change drastically, as more of these media go digital. So, To go into a little bit of background to show how central first sale is, just how copyright law works, as David actually covered, is, you know, it grants the copyright holder the right, the exclusive right, to do certain specific things, right? They're the only ones who can make reproductions of their work. They're the only ones who can make public performances of their work. They're also the only ones who can make distributions of the work and make public displays of that work. Now, if you take that at face value without adding anything to it, that means, since they're the only ones who can make distributions of copies of their work, that if I own a book, if I give that to somebody else, if I sell that, if I lend it to somebody else, that's a distribution. And that could be an infringement. This was pretty early on, over 100 years ago, recognized as not being a workable sort of situation. You can't have that sort of barrier to distribution of copies of works you know, going all the way down the chain. So the first sale exception says that if I am the owner of a particular copy of a work that was lawfully made, if I own this particular set of pages of paper with printing on it, if I own this particular DVD, I can distribute that how I want to, so long as those copies were made lawfully. This breaks down a little bit when we're talking about digital works that weren't necessarily tied to a particular physical object. So, for instance, if we're talking about a file that I've bought off of the iTunes store or off of Amazon, an MP3, well, that was never sort of fixed to a particular distinct, you know, drive or a particular distinct CD that I now can easily claim title to. What happens then when I'm done with it, when I want to resell it? Can I lend it? All of these things change drastically. So we have three particular problems that come out of this. One of them is actually, especially when we come to digital media, and it's been particularly prominent in software, is every time I use that work, just every time I want to view it or access it or listen to it, I'm making copies of it in the digital realm. This is something that wasn't necessarily true before. Certainly, when I pick up a paper book, using it, reading it, doesn't involve any of the exclusive rights that a copyright owner has. They can't stop me from reading it. If I'm reading an ebook, well, copies of it go into RAM. Copies of it might be cached. And so all of those things are reproductions. There are particular exceptions that apply when I'm the owner of a copy for RAM copies and things like that. But increasingly, we're seeing contracts bundled with digital media that you will get you click through that will say, well, according to this contract, you're not the owner, and therefore you don't get those. So every use of a digital work could be a reproduction, one of the exclusive rights, which isn't included in first sale, and you could face liability for that. Another problem, distribution. Digital distribution also involves reproductions, right? I mean, if I send you a file, I'm not actually taking carving chunks out of my hard drive and mailing them to you. A copy is made at some point in the process. And one of the, and this is actually, there's active litigation on this involving a company based here called Redigi. One of the things they do is they have a cloud locker service for people's music. So you buy a track off of iTunes or Amazon, and you can upload it to your cloud locker. Only you can access it, but you can access it wherever you want. And then they have this other feature that they call sort of used MP3 sales or used digital music sales, where basically if I'm done with a track, if I'm like I decide I don't like this too much anymore, I can basically say, okay, transfer this to somebody else. I put it on a market, and if somebody else buys it, it's deactivated from my account, so I can no longer access it in the cloud. It runs through, you know, some little bit of software that looks at my hard drive and looks for copies of it and deletes them. And then it grants access on the cloud to the second user, to the buyer. So in the end, you've got a one-to-one correspondence with what would happen in a traditional sale. You enter with one copy in the hands of person A, you exit with one copy in the hands of person B. Of course, the mechanism by which that happens, at some point, this file has actually been copied. And so you have a reproduction in there. And then there's an active question as to whether or not, and it's being litigated right now, as to whether or not that's an infringement of copyright. A third problem with digital media generally, and I won't go into this too much, is just the fact that unlike a book, you can put DRM on it. So we can leave that discussion for later. But part of why I think this is so important is because the existence of first sale, really, it has to do with us being able to reconcile copyright ownership with the ownership of physical goods, with the ownership of personal property. It's the way that the law allows us to both say, no, just because there's copyrights in things don't mean you don't own your own stuff. And I think as more and more stuff goes digital, we have fewer and fewer owners, property owners. So happy to cover that in the following discussion.
Thanks, Sherwin. Phil?
So I'm going to stand up, not because I like standing up, but just because I'm otherwise 100 miles away from all of you over here in this corner. So I'll try to move over here and be a little bit closer. So I'm going to follow up on Jason's theme of copyright and intellectual property for good rather than evil, and take it sort of in a different direction and talk about a different aspect of the dynamic of the intersection between intellectual property and innovation, one that on first blush maybe doesn't seem to have that much to do with technology, and that's open access publishing, the idea of open access to at least academic and scholarly works that historically have appeared in journals. It's not technology related in the same way. It's not some really cool new service like Aereo or somebody's figured out a really sophisticated technological way to solve a problem. But it's very much a technology issue in two ways. One, a lot of the writing we're talking about is very much about technology. So we're talking about computer scientists, researchers of all kinds through the sciences and other disciplines and the work that they produce and that they try to get out to their audiences. But second, it's a technology issue because changes in technology, digital publishing and the internet in particular, have fundamentally changed the way this business and this market works and created a lot of really new, tricky issues where intellectual property comes into play in a completely different way. So what are we talking about? Well, the traditional publishing model for journals, as you know, is academics work away somewhere on a research project, they write up an article, they send it to a journal, it's selected, then other academics do peer review usually to pick the article and make sure it's good enough. Publisher then publishes it, and in the old days that meant putting it into, you know, this very nice, beautiful bound paper volume and then shipping those paper volumes on trucks and airplanes and boats all around the world into libraries and other institutions, where it's then used by lots of people, but primarily other researchers. Internet totally changes this, right? So today, most academic journals, most journals of all kind, are online. They're digital. There may still be some paper copies for libraries that have to have them, but most of the way these works live, most of the way these articles exist, is digitally. And they're distributed online, and they're distributed very easily. The marginal cost of making extra copies and distributing them to institutions or people around the world is extremely low, right? You just distribute it over the internet. So what that means is for the publisher, the value that they add to the process has now changed dramatically. There's no longer really much value in printing up these great things and distributing them all over the world and using up lots of papers and paper and killing trees, right? So now their primary role is to still, you know, maybe select articles, maybe manage the peer review process, although the actual peer review is contributed by other academics who are doing it almost always for free, not paid by the journals. And then the journals offer these out to institutions for lots and lots of money. So they're really adding a whole lot less to the value chain now as a result of the internet than they used to. And it's really kind of an odd business if you think about it, right? The people who create these works, the authors and creators, are academics who are doing it for free. The journals don't pay them to do it. The people who do the peer review and usually are involved in the selection are academics doing it for free. And then, so they put in all this free labor to create these works. The publishers then add, you know, the bit of value that they do. They then sell them back to the very institutions and the very researchers who have created them for huge amounts of money, right? There are now some online journals from some of the top publishers that cost $40,000 a year for online access. $40,000 a year for the work that academics did for free and gave to them and peer reviewed for free. And it turns out for lots of publishers, profit margins are still quite high. It's a very good business to be in, not surprisingly, right? You cut your cost way down, you increase the prices at which you distribute this stuff. Not so bad, right? I think most of us wouldn't mind being in that kind of business. Unfortunately, it's become a bit of a crisis for people on the consuming end, for consumers, for libraries, research institutions, and so on, because the prices have gone steadily up and up and up, and in some cases, publishers have bundled together really high-demand, important journals with some other chunky stuff. It's kind of like cable packages, right? You have to take the, you know, Cincinnati Barbecue Network in order to get HBO and some other things that you want. The system is
not
sufficient.
For long. There you go. The system is sufficiently broken that a couple of months ago, the Harvard Faculty Advisory Council issued a sort of advisory to all faculty members, really decrying the huge increase in prices and calling the sort of continuing subscriptions under this model financially untenable and a path that cannot be sustained. This is Harvard, the most, you know, wealthy and well-resourced research institution in the world. If they're seeing the cost of journals as a huge, huge problem, imagine what it's like for smaller institutions with very limited research, very limited library and acquisition budgets. In fact, at Harvard, the university says that last year, maybe 2010, the cost of online journals was $3.25 million. About 10% of the total library acquisitions of all kind, and steadily increasing. So this sort of situation, this problem, has given rise to the open access movement over the last 8 or 10 years. And that basically just means that articles that are published in this way are available online for free. So maybe you still get them through a journal, you know, maybe a journal still exists, but you can also, you being the public, you being businesses, you being other innovators, you being institutions, and access the articles for free online. And it's generated a huge amount of controversy. There have been headlines just about every day over the last year or so about this that you've probably seen. And I want to just tick off three or four very quickly, and I'm happy to talk more about those later on. One is university open access policies. So Harvard was one of the first to do this. There are now over 30 major universities that have taken similar steps. And they basically require faculty members to give the university a license in every article they publish ahead of time. And then the university can put that article into an open access repository hosted by the university that anyone anywhere can come to and access. Articles usually still get published in journals and still have that channel of distribution, but they're also available free online in an open access repository. Second is government funding mandates. So 4 or 5 years ago, the National Institutes of Health began a mandate that says all work, all publications resulting from NIH funding have to be deposited into an open access repository called PubMed Central. There's some timing issues and embargoes and so on, but essentially every article that results from NIH funding is available at some point freely through an open access repository. As you can imagine, the publishers have mostly hated this and hated this sort of development, and they've pushed back very hard. There have been several bills introduced in Congress over the last several years to stop the NIH mandate and to ban any future government mandates like that. There was one this year called the Research Works Act that generated a lot of controversy and really a huge backlash from academics and others, and the bill was eventually sort of declared dead, but we'll certainly see it again. On the other side, there's legislation this year called FERPA, the Federal Research Publication Access Act, that would expand the NIH mandate to 11 other federal agencies and all of the work that they fund, so that pretty much everything the government funds would be available through an open access system. And if you think about it, it's especially crazy the way the system works now in the context of government-funded publications, because there, in addition to the things I described earlier, it's you, it's us, it's the taxpayers who are paying for the work to be done, for the researcher to do the research and write the article. It then goes to the journal, they kind of, you know, pretty it up, and then sell it back to the public for $40,000 a year for a journal. Makes no sense at all in that sense. So there's this big pushback to try to expand that. The White House also had, through the Office of Science, Technology, and Policy, has an ongoing public comment process to perhaps think about extending the open access mandate through an executive order as opposed to legislation. Some private funders, charitable foundations, and so on, are now requiring that the results of work they fund have to be deposited in open access repositories as well. So there's a lot happening on that front. So let me just finish by saying, so why does it matter, right? Who cares if Harvard has to spend a little bit more of its, you know, zillions of dollars on journals than it does now? As I said, it's a huge access problem for most of the rest of the world. particularly when you get outside the top tier of research institutions. For smaller institutions, for researchers in other countries, and then you think about the other people who can use and make use of these kind of publications, whether it's businesses, entrepreneurs and innovators, you know, new inventors who want to rely on some of this, smaller startup pharmaceutical companies, scientific companies, computer programmers and developers. Lots of those people are effectively frozen out of access to much of this research now. And if you think about it from the standpoint of intellectual property, copyright is supposed to be about creating incentives. It's supposed to be about giving enough rights to the creator to create sufficient incentives for them to go out and produce and create lots of stuff. Right? That's the reason we tolerate this temporary, it's now very long, but this temporary monopoly over control of a work, because it's supposed to create the right incentives for people to go out and invent and write and publish. But at the same time, there's always a cost. And the cost is all of the people who would then take that work, take the ideas, take the research that's described, take the data, and build on it and do subsequent innovation. What Sir Isaac Newton described as standing on the shoulders of giants to do further innovation. All of them are restricted in their ability to do that if they can't access the works in the first place. So there's always a cost. And part of the open access movement is to try to shift the balance and say, you know what, we don't necessarily need this full copyright to publishers and then control over the distribution system to create the incentives, because academics have lots of other incentives to publish. And with the internet, the work's all going to get distributed anyway. And at the same time, we're imposing a huge cost on innovation, subsequent innovators who can't get access to and take advantage of some of this work. So open access is a way of shifting that balance back in a way that's better for innovation, better for overall use of the work that people do. I'm going to stop there. Happy to talk about any aspect of this as we go along.
Thanks, Phil. Lots of great stuff there. So many different places we could dive in. Let me start with something that Phil mentioned and Jason mentioned. You both used the sort of good and evil, and I know you both had tongues in cheeks when you said that. But you know, this is a panel that's supposed to be about IP and innovation. Phil mentioned the sort of the underpinnings of copyright law in the U.S. Come from the U.S. Constitution. Congress is empowered to pass laws that promote the progress of science and the useful arts, and we have done that by creating incentives, traditionally economic incentives, short-term monopolies over creative works, expressive works under copyright, and inventions under patent that allow people who create things some period of time to have the sole ability to exploit those works. Is this notion, Jason, from the defensive patent license, is the notion of defensive patent license with its goal of good, of avoiding litigation, is that compatible or incompatible with a business incentive to also invent things and build businesses on the backs of patents?
Definitely. I mean, along with what Phil said, when you're creating good intellectual property policies, I think you have to think about both sides, right? You want to think about enough incentives or protection for people to recoup their investments and get a return, and not to prevent the next great thing or great things from happening. And with patents, particularly in the software and kind of online or technology-driven business areas, a lot of those R&D costs are there, but they're not so high that you need a 20-year exclusive control kind of model like you might in some other industries. I mean, it's debatable in the pharmaceutical industry, but it's at least there's a lot more evidence there that you need heavier, longer-term investments that you might need to recoup through patent rights over, like, the one drug that's successful out of, you know, 1,000. And so, but with the thing about the DPL is it's a self-selecting a mechanism. You don't have, no one has to use it. If it fits your business model, then you should use it, right? Or your value set, right? Your value set might say, I value making money, but I also value these other things. And I value sort of free and open technology, and I value this kind of a purpose of, you know, creating an opportunity for those of us of like mind to reduce the amount of patent litigation and that. I should say, though, that it works very much in a kind of shared community, shared value community way, in the sense that, let's say, Microsoft is not interested in the DPL at all. If there are, you know, 1,000 DPL patents and those folks are comfortable with each other because they've all made this commitment, but Microsoft is not, all 1,000 patents could go and be asserted against Microsoft, and it's not a violation of the DPL because Microsoft's not a member of the network, right? No, they haven't made any agreements. It only applies as to those. So again, from a business model point of view, any entity that has not offered its own patents and taken licenses is fair game for, you know, suing for royalties and things. That was one of the decisions we had to make, actually, in designing it, was do you need to be defensive as to the entire world or just to everyone else who makes similar agreements? And we decided to go that route for that reason, that some people felt like, well, I'm comfortable with some people getting all of my technology for free because they've made shared commitments. Other people, I'm not as comfortable.
I would just add very quickly to that, you know, in spite of my sort of getting worked up about open access, I'm not anti-IP at all or anti-copyright, and this idea of good and evil is not a stark binary. There's tremendous value in copyright and patent and in IP in a lot of situations. The thing that I keep coming back to is it is very context specific. There are certain situations where having really strong copyright protection, being able to enforce it for reasonable periods, is very important to incenting the creative process. There are places where patents are really important. There are other places, you know, lots of what happens in Silicon Valley, where patents mostly get in the way and mostly create real problems. And so I'm an advocate both on the policy side, but also on the practice by individual companies and inventors side, a very thoughtful, deliberate IP strategy, not kind of a knee-jerk, oh, lock it all up and protect it or release it all under Creative Commons, but really very thoughtful depending on what it is you're trying to do and what your business model is. There are times where strong copyright use will really help you. Other business situations where using open models and open licensing can be a huge boost to your business, and it just depends on what you're doing.
Yeah, no, well, I had a question to ask you because you said something that I found interesting, and it's a topic that I've had lots of discussions both with clients and other people in the publishing industry about what the value it is mm-hmm. that a publisher adds yep. at this point. And you know, it's interesting because the trade publishers have been awful at this because it really is sort of branding. What right. what they really add at this point is they're the content control. They are the funnel through which people, if they trust that particular publisher, can go to and they can say, well, this is something that I should read because it's coming from a source that even though they're not the author, they've approved it in a sense. And I would think that that same dynamic, which has not been exploited well at all on the trade publisher side, actually probably has been exploited better on the academic side because there is this aspect of the gatekeeper.
Yep.
And to what extent, if you know, the open content movement is more successful, to what extent will you really still have that, what I view as to some degree a very important aspect mm-hmm. of the gatekeeping function that the publisher still does serve, even though they don't publish by paper anymore.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It's really this idea in some ways within academic publishing of prestige, right? So if you're, you know, on a certain track within certain fields of sciences, you have to get published in Nature or Science or Cell or whatever it is in your field in order to get the jobs at the top institution. So there is still this selection process and prestige, and that's part of what has made it difficult to get academics to kind of voluntarily adopt open access, to say, oh, I'm not going to publish in Nature, I'll go publish in, you know, Phil's open access journal and that'll be just as good. So there's, I think there is an important role, but I also think that role can be played. There's nothing about the open access system that negates that in any way. You could certainly have you know, articles published openly and then still, you know, put in repositories, PubMed Central or wherever, which is happening now, and still have journals who sort of go through the selection process and say, okay, we science have picked these 10 as the very best. I don't think that adds so much value that you need to be charging $40,000 a year for the journal, but I do think there's some value. And I think, you know, we're going to see a real shakeout over the next 10 years. My own sense is big name journals will still exist. There are a lot of open access journals that are gaining credibility and taking on this gatekeeper function. And to be honest, there's no reason that can't be done on a, you know, more or less free basis as well. It's a big shift. But I think over time, we're going to see both continue to survive. I don't think the financial model of extracting so much
for that, what I think is relatively limited contribution, is going to continue them.
Yeah, but I would just add that I think your point, David, is really good. When we think about how to test whether intellectual property systems are working well, it's important to think about what should we be measuring. And yeah, I think if we think about open access, the question is, are people who have knowledge to communicate able to communicate it to the audiences they want to reach? And are those audiences able to access that knowledge or scholarship or, you know, whatever that particular form of knowledge is? And what systems would maximize the production, distribution, and access of knowledge? And with the DPL, it's what systems would allow people to create and innovate as much as possible with the least amount of, you know, transaction costs or overhead or inhibitions or prohibitions, right? And so, yeah, I think, you know, the publishers themselves, I think, I actually put the burden on them to say, yeah, how are, not so much, you know, can you stay in business or not? Because that's kind of a middle question to me. The question is, how much knowledge are you helping to disseminate, and how much access do people have to the knowledge you disseminate, and what could you be doing to do that more or maximize that, and then how much does it cost to do that? And then once they say, well, here's our plan to make sure the most people gain access to the most knowledge, and here's how much it costs, then I'm interested, okay, well, do we have enough incentives for them to do that? And if they don't, then I'm actually open to increasing the intellectual property protections if that's necessary. But I think starting with that more basic question, to me, is a better place to go.
So we're talking today about a bunch of areas where sort of innovation bumps up against the law, and I think that we've heard, you know, from Jason about one way to kind of address that is through sort of norms, these voluntary systems that can be designed to address those kinds of situations, specifically in the patent world. And Phil's talking about a situation where we might rethink business models. You know, David, you mentioned the technology moves very quickly, the law moves very slowly. And Sherman, you were talking about, you know, Section 106 of the Copyright Act, which prohibits reproduction of works, and we live in a world where every minute each of us is surfing the internet, we're reproducing works left and right. You know, it seems to me like in addition to changing norms and developing business models, one reaction when this happens is to change the law. And I don't want to seem too naive, but why is that so difficult? And sure, when you work for Public Knowledge, which is probably more directly than any of us, an organization that's in DC that has lobbyists, I think, yeah, and that actually is on the Hill advocating for changes in law, why can't we, if we all agree if we all agree that the first sale doctrine, that there are some interesting open questions around first sale right now in the digital world, or we all agree that the reproduction right in Section 106 really ought to be clarified when we're all copying things left and right in RAM.
Why not?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. One was just questions of inertia, and also the fact that, you know, I guess when you say we all agree, maybe that's because we're all on, you know, it's all sitting up here on this particular panel. There's people with billions upon billions of dollars who I think would disagree vehemently with us. But another aspect of it is, in terms of you know, the use and reproduction, like, you know, every time you use a piece of software, it's reproduced, you know, you're possibly on the hook for liability-wise. That's something that you know, only emerged relatively recently, that it was something that was only considered relatively recently, right? You know, we didn't have, you know, speaking in legal time frames, which are just short of, you know, on a couple of, just an order of magnitude shorter than geological. I mean, we're talking about, you know, people who, you know, we're talking about laws that were written before home recording existed. We're talking about laws that actually, even when they were passed, it was unclear whether or not software would be considered copyrightable. So the idea that every use could be an infringement is a more recent one, and it's recent enough that I think it sets software aside from other types of media, that there has become a business norm in the software realm to have these EULAs that hasn't fully invaded other realms. You don't get a EULA when you buy a CD or a DVD that says you don't own this physical object. You do actually get that with software. It's buried in there somewhere. And I think the idea that you have media encoded as bits instead of physical objects means that those EULAs will start to apply to those as well. So I think there's a bit of inertia and there's a bit of sort of mission creep in the EULAs as they move from the software realm into other things. I think that's actually, that existence of that norm in software is going to be a big barrier.
And I also think that there's a lot of fear. I mean, understandably, particularly with respect to the institutions that have had virtual monopolies for an extended period of time, particularly in the media world. And that's true whether you're talking about publishers or you're talking about broadcasters. You know, when you consider the fact that, you know, as little as 20 years ago, to read a book, you had to read a book. You couldn't read a book online, and nobody ever conceived of that. And what that meant was the barriers to entry in the marketplace were exceptionally high, and so publishers didn't have to brand themselves because they competed against other publishers, but there were a very limited number of those. So they could brand their authors, for example, and people would, as long as they kept their authors happy and as long as they had a good stable of authors, they didn't need to worry about whether or not people knew that it was Putnam that published these particular books or Bantam that published those particular books. What's happened is the barriers to entry have dropped almost to zero in a number of different industries. And it set off really a panic. Understandably, in those industries, because now all of a sudden, it does matter. It does, you know. Again, it comes back to the gatekeeper function. That's really the function, you know. I mean, the value, if you talk to people in the publishing industry, of the publisher at this point are the editors, and not just the editors who actually edit the books, but the people, you know, two-thirds of a managerial editor's job at a large publishing house is to acquire material. Is to go out and find the material that's worth publishing. And what the move now is really to try to rebrand these huge entities. And the same is true in the broadcast world. You know, again, we tend not to think about it, but 25 years ago, 75% of America got between 2 and 4 channels, and they got them over the air. And that was it. And so if you were one of those that had the license to broadcast over the air, you really had not quite a monopoly, but I guess an oligopoly. And now those barriers are coming down as well, too. And that is causing an enormous amount of pressure. To me, my view is, this again comes back to a gatekeeper function. I think a lot of businesses have to re-envision what they are and what their role is. The role is not necessarily providing the infrastructure to deliver the programming. The role is to really be the content control and be the source that people turn to for various different types of programming, and that's really the value that they have to capitalize on.
And I think what's interesting about that is it means that you start seeing lawsuits. The more that you see consumers with the ability to access and manipulate media in different ways, the more we play with bits, the more lawsuits you see. And I think Aereo and Dish, two bits of litigation going on right now, are key examples of this. And the way in which the broadcasting networks like frame their arguments actually says a lot about why they file these lawsuits. Like, for instance, Dish has this DVR they call the Hopper, and one of the things it does is you can turn on a feature that programs it to record like 3 hours of prime time on all the 4 major channels every day, and it has another feature that actually automatically that if you it'll ask you, do you want to skip all the commercials on this show, and if you say yes, it skips all the commercials on that show.
It has a feature that you can also go out and steal a car from a network executive and deliver it to
that's
you
version
later
two.
That day. But that's for next year.
That's been turned off for now.
The fun thing about this is, you know, when they file their complaint and they say, you know, it skips commercials and this is a terrible thing, and it records, you know, massive amounts of TV and this is a terrible thing. And of course, neither of these things are particularly different from what a TiVo can do today. It's not particularly different from what a Betamax could do in 1984. But they talk about it in terms of competing with VOD, and competing with video on demand. And that's what annoys them about this. And to talk about David's clients, you know, Aereo is offering a service that has you rent an antenna in Brooklyn, and it captures over the air broadcasting that you could watch with an antenna if you happen to live in a place without too many tall buildings.
By the way, just for the record, I'm not saying that everything that he says is absolutely accurate. Okay, I don't want to describe to me you're my client.
I'm not. Oh yeah. And likewise, no, anyway, and so you know, and it transmits it over the internet to a subscriber within the same broadcast area, and you can watch it on your TV. Now, what the plaintiffs say in their complaint is, well, but this is very similar to what traditional cable retransmission is, and therefore it should be treated exactly like existing cable retransmission. And again, their concern is they have an existing revenue stream, and this resembles that revenue stream enough for them to say, well, legally it must be the same thing.
Just one thing I'd add real quick that all of this brings up is this recurring tension that we see in intellectual property disputes and in IP generally between the interests that the IP system is supposed to protect and the interest of sort of existing business models. And whenever we're thinking about one of these situations, we have to be very careful to tease out what's at stake. Is it really, as Jason described earlier, an optimal system to ensure the maximum production and sort of the most distribution and usage for consumers, or is it protecting a particular business model that may not now be the most efficient way to go about something? And you know, going back to the VCR, we see lots of issues. We see it in the music industry, we see it now in the publishing industry. A lot of what's at stake is concern by incumbent industries about their industry. Doesn't mean that they're wrong, and sometimes they play an important role, but we always have to separate out that interest from the interest that the intellectual property system is supposed to be protecting.
Yeah, one other thing I wanted to also link is the first sale doctrine in this question of kind of once you get a copy to actually issues of privacy. One of the other things that the first sale doctrine has done traditionally is if you buy a book from a publisher or a bookstore, that's the last thing the publisher ever hears about it. If you go to a used bookstore, you give it to a friend. Even when libraries loan books out to patrons, they keep those records very private. Many state laws and a lot of the librarian codes of conduct prohibits them from disclosing that, and there have been several famous court cases about the attempts to get reader records disclosed. And one of the things I think that is another aspect of why certain content industries don't want for sale to exist is because of tracking. I think they want to have a better sense of who is buying their stuff, when they're using it, gathering data, because that has become a major business model, obviously, for tracking. For a lot of other companies too, but I think content companies are interested in getting a lot of value out of that. So I think that's also mixed into why it's important to have first sale, is it gives you more privacy.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see people like tout their DRM systems for ebooks, saying, "Well, no, we let you lend books and we let you share books," and also, you know, so it'll also suggest, I'm sure, it's but part of that DRM system will be it will track who is lending what to whom. So it'll say, "We see that you lend 50 Shades of Grey from Jason. So, you know, you might also like."
I want to keep this going, but I also want to be sure we open this up because we have probably about 10 or 12 more minutes left here. Any questions from the audience for this great, great panel? Just feel free to stand up or raise your hand. I'm happy to call on folks. Yeah, please.
I think it depends on who you're talking to, whether or not it resonates or not. I'm not sure that I've seen a wide enough discussion that I could make a judgment call. So, well, you know, 90% of Americans think this. And part of that, I think, has to do with from what direction people address the issue, right? A lot of them are saying, well, if it's digital and it's cheaper, then maybe I'm accepting the fact that I can't resell it. You know, maybe since I bought this game on discount off of Steam, I should just accept the fact that I can't do that. I think when you're starting to see it, I think it resonates more when you're talking about something like books that are much more traditionally handed down from person to person, given as gifts passed through generations, amassed into libraries and so on. That people who probably weren't coming at it from the software side of things, who aren't used to having EULAs attached to their media, I think that resonates a bit more strongly with those types of media. and those types of users.
Yeah, one of the things that I think has put a lot of content companies in a pickle with regard to this, where I think you'll see that tension kind of probably being litigated at some point or being resolved, is how they market these goods. The Federal Trade Commission has historically at least issued letters or talked to various companies that did go out of business but changed their business model, who tried to, quote, sell or allow people to buy digital files or digital experiences. Major League Baseball said, own the experience. And I think that kind of terminology, which is marketing, right? They're telling you what you're going to get for your money. You're buying something, or they're selling something, or you're owning something. I think the reason they're using those terms is because they resonate with us. We want to own or buy, or we want them to sell certain things. If they said, we will license or rent or give this to you for 30 days and then we're going to take it back, that's a different thing. And I think people react differently, and they may not invest as much money in that. And so I think what we've seen is, and the Federal Trade Commission, you know, has jurisdiction over this primarily through deceptive advertising or market business practice kind of approach, is that the vendors need to be very clear what you're getting. And I think that, you know, is a little clearer in software. And I think, but I think to the extent, like, if iTunes were to go out of business and then all of a sudden you couldn't access your music, which is what happened with Walmart's MP3 music service, and I think Microsoft also had a problem, then I think it creates problems for them. And in those cases, the way they kind of resolved the FTC's questions was to offer sort of DRM-free MP3s on everything, or various sort of, you know, truly allowing people to own things. So I think that's where you'll see some of the conflict, and I think it could probably get resolved in favor of ownership if the companies have marketed it as a different thing.
Do you have another question over here? Yep.
I had a comment and a question. My comment is that my understanding is that the idea of EULAs is actually not new. That at the end of the 19th century, publishers attempted to put EULAs on books, and the Supreme Court slapped them down.
No, actually, the entire reason we have the first sale doctrine today is because of a EULA attached to a book in 1903?
1908.
Yeah.
But I had a question about the DPL. It's maybe a detailed question, but I'm thinking about big companies like IBM, who have really built their business on patented technology and licensing patents and so forth. Is there some kind of a provision or incentive to get those people to join, or are they going to have to give up their entire portfolio to be able to join the DPL?
So this is one of the reasons we're still tweaking with the license a bit. Jennifer and I have a very lengthy law review article, and if you love law review articles, you should read it. If you don't, you shouldn't. On SSRN, about kind of all the reasons and justifications for why we thought the all-in model made sense, primarily because it's, I think, in some ways too hard to police the gaming, where people would just put in their junk patents and keep the really good ones out. And so this kind of forces you to go all in, and then people don't have to worry as much. And in fact, that was one of the criticisms of IBM. IBM, I think, at one point took 500 patents and said, everyone can use these. And people were like, yeah, because they're worthless. That was the criticism. I don't know if it's true, I should say. So that's one thing. But there's actually already been a reaction paper written to our proposal suggesting a way that companies with substantial portfolios could become more interested. And it was actually written by David Hayes, is a very famous intellectual property lawyer at Fenwick & West in his individual capacity, and also the director of patents for Google, Eric Schulman, in his individual capacity. So not committing their companies and firms, but just what they thought individually, where they propose a kind of way to get IBMs and other kind of substantial portfolio companies more interested. It's a little difficult to explain, but I can give you the link or point you to it. They basically say that there should be a kind of way to make certain patents sticky, in the sense that they are in while they're in, but then if you pull out of the DPL, then you can get them out again, and it kind of gives you a way to put your toe in the water.
Other questions or comments?
So I wanted to ask a hypothetical about the open access thing. So the USENIX Association is open access. All of our papers, the video of this talk, is all going to be online free. That's great. And all of our historical papers are out. Other conferences and journals, not so much. So let me give you a hypothetical. Pretend that all the academics get together and agree that hereforth we'll no longer publish with Elsevier and Springer and the legacy publishers. Everything goes online free. And let's even hypothetically pretend we've sorted out the business model, which is an interesting question. But take that as a given. What are the legacy publishers, the Elsevier, the Springer, going to do when they, you know, when we're like, we're not giving you our papers anymore, we're publishing over here? How's that, how are we going to deal with our legacy content locked up with legacy publishers?
The hypothetical started with the phrase, all academics agree. Okay, I just wanted to make sure, okay. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, it's funny you say that because there is now an academic boycott of the Elsevier and I think some other journals that some scientists have started that now has something like 8,000 members. And you know, once you start talking about all academics agreeing, then people's red flags go up. But I think it's a fair question. You know, if we ever came to a world where everything going forward was open access, you would have some issues about legacy stuff. I think it's going to be more gradual and ultimately more orderly than that. You know, I think Elsevier and others are going to figure out their various business models that may work for them and their other open access business models that have you know, the author or the author's institution paying some amount for the publication. So I think there are a lot of models going forward. I don't think we're going to get stuck in a situation where we have this big chunk of previous content that is sort of held hostage or disappears. But I would say, going back to the idea of the first sale doctrine, this is another place where this idea of ownership versus licensing comes up, right? In the past, libraries acquired physical stuff. They got books, they got hard copies of journals. They were theirs forever. Now what happens is they pay $40,000 a year to a publisher. They get, you know, online access to a journal. They don't keep paying, that access goes away. It's the equivalent of, in the past, the publisher backing up a truck to the library and saying, oh, we're gonna take all those books back, thank you very much. That's a very scary situation for libraries that see themselves as sort of long-term caretakers and curators of knowledge. To have this knowledge now in a more ephemeral status that's owned by a third party with a profit motive. So I think that's part of what's driving a lot of the discomfort around the current state of publishing.
And I think this actually goes to Sherwin's push on digital first sale. So if you consider that the reason for sale is a fair practice is because it sort of has a one-to-one ratio of ownership to usage. It, you know, with a physical book, it's hard for more than one person to read it at a time, right? So the sort of nature of the rivalry there, it's like, well, it's not so threatening to the copyright owner because it's only one. If you apply that kind of a philosophy to digital copies, so like one person, only one person can use a journal article at a time, right? The kind of loan model. You actually could say, well, all those academics, if you have paper copies of some of these old journals, we could scan them. And then we could say only one scanned version of the article is available to one person at a given time. And if we had the similar rules, and if those were rules we could apply, maybe we could get to the back catalog without Elsevier.
This is great. I'd love to keep it going. I think we're up against time. So maybe we'll wrap this up, say thank you to the panel, take a really short break, invite Ed to come up for his keynote. Thanks, Jason, Dave, Sherwin, and Phil for your contributions.